2011, Mel Jacob was living in a nice house. Her husband, Patrick, was running a prosperous online business. And they had two lovely kids. And the house even had a white picket fence. Then one day, the police arrived to search her house. Mel was told that her husband had been placed under arrest. And this made absolutely no sense whatsoever to Mel. Patrick was a very nice man, a good and kind person. But when Patrick was sent to jail for 2 years, Mel Jacob had to reconfigure her whole life. She had to manage her way through the logistical problems of prison visits at a distance and of her new life as a single mum. And then there was the business of what she was supposed to say when people asked her where Patrick was. And what were her kids supposed to say? Mel Jacob's memoir of this time is called In Sickness, In Health and In Jail. Hi, Mel.
Hi, Richard. It's great to be here.
Tell me how you met Patrick.
Well, we first met through some mutual friends, and actually Patrick and I tell very different stories about how we first met.
Yes, couples tend to do that, yes.
Well, he says that he saw me at a party, at a New Year's Eve party, and he said to himself that I was the woman that he was going to marry, but I had no recollection of that night. Apparently I met him, but it didn't make an impression.
He thought he was going to marry you just on first
yes,
sight.
Yes.
And you have... That didn't register with you at all at the time.
No, it didn't. And so, but we did meet about a month later at a barbecue.
And what was he doing at the barbecue when you saw him?
He was actually doing something that I was very unimpressed with. He was wrestling with some other guys, wrestling on the ground, on the grass. And so he stood up and he'd actually ripped his T-shirt and he was covered in grass stains. And I was quite repulsed. I thought, oh, you know, who is this guy? This is just embarrassing. He's an adult. He's not a teenager. He's not a kid anymore. And
still, he looked all right in the...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, he still is very, very handsome. And he... at the time, he doesn't have this anymore, but he had this incredible six-pack peeking through his T-shirt. But still, I didn't think that he was my type at all, because I thought that I was going to end up with this bookish intellectual, and we'd, you know, discuss literature over pillow talk and that sort of thing.
Why was it important for you at that time to... You said you were trying to cultivate, very self-consciously, trying to cultivate this kind of air of sophistication about you. Why was that so important to you at the time?
Well, I came from a small country town and I grew up on the wrong side of town, on the worst street in the town. And I really felt the sting of that shame growing up. And so I really love school. I really love learning. And I'm from a really great family, really loving family, and they really encouraged education and creativity and really encouraged me to go to university and try and, you know, do something other than stay in that small country town. And that was so important to me at the time.
How did other kids, when you were little, make you feel about living in the wrong side of the tracks?
Well, it wasn't until I was sort of late primary school age, the age that my children are at now, sort of 10 years old, 8 and 10 years old my kids are now, and then in high school that I started to feel the sting of that often kids would tease me, yell after me about and tease me about the name of the street that I lived on, or throw rocks and things like that.
But they throw rocks at you.
Yes.
But they throw rocks at you and call you a bogan. They see the logical fallacy there, do they? I mean, that's pretty unkind. But did you know then you were living on the wrong side of the tracks until other kids gave you a hard time about it?
I didn't initially, no. And around that, when I was 11, I think my parents bought a house in this new development, and it was a new house, but it was actually completely surrounded by housing commission houses. And so we were excited initially to be in this a different house and a new house, our own house. And it was only later when I started to get teased about this area, and I started to notice things like, you know, the windows boarded up and people sitting in the gutter drinking and that kind of thing. Did I really feel the shame of that?
Well, obviously you wanted to propel yourself out of that. How did you manage to do that once you finished school, Mel?
Well, I think I did that mainly because of the support from my family. Like my mother, she is an extremely intelligent and creative woman, and she would have liked to go on and study at university, but she found herself pregnant at a very young age, and she didn't do that. So she did everything that she could to give us the opportunities that she didn't have. And so I think that really I was able to do that because of the support of my parents.
So there you are, as someone who's very serious about wanting culture and all those kinds of things, and you met Patrick. What did Patrick bring out in you once you met him?
Yeah, well, even though I wanted to, embrace culture and have a different kind of lifestyle to the one that I'd grown up in, I think I at that time I was taking myself far too seriously. And Patrick brought something out in me. He was a really, really positive person, really fun. He's such a great storyteller in person. And he just had this like really charismatic kind of energy that sort of drew me to him like a magnet.
It seems to be like a very sweet guy, a real sweetness to him. Was he involved in a lot of community activities at the time when you met him?
Absolutely. And when we first got married, he a lot of our conflicts, it's quite funny, but he we'd often have arguments about him giving away our best blankets and quilts to homeless people on the street. And while that's a really nice thing to do, here I'd be saying, you know, that was our best blanket, or that was, you know, 100%, you know, virgin wool. What are you doing giving that away? And so he's very, very kind.
You once saw him defend a man on a train when this man was being abused. Tell me what happened, what you saw that day.
Yes, well, when we were travelling home from the city on the train commute, Patrick was sitting down, and just next to him there was a really tiny little Asian guy, and a man came up, and he'd been assaulting someone earlier, and we'd heard that in the platform, and then he continued it on the train, and then
verbal assault or was
yes
it,
yeah. on both verbal and he'd started hitting somebody, and then he came up, and Patrick thought maybe it was just an assault between two people who knew each other, but then this man walked up and he started hitting into this small Asian man who was asleep next to Patrick. And so Patrick stood up and said, you know, mate, what are you doing? Stop that. And at which point the attacker started punching Patrick and punched him square in the face. And Patrick just continued with these empty threats. He just kept saying, you know, mate, you're skating on very thin ice. You know, if you do that again.
Patrick got hit in the face.
Yes. Several times.
And then stood up and kept saying to him, you've got to stop doing that.
Yeah, right? He just kept saying, you know, come on, mate, you know, and then he stopped calling him mate and just kept saying, you know, he was trying to appeal to his good sense. He's always thought the very best of people.
And he just kept doing that until the guy stopped?
Well, he only stopped because some other men on the train actually intervened and restrained the man and called security, but Patrick just kept trying to appeal to his good nature.
How straight was Patrick, you know, when it came to sort of like, you know, was he one of those guys that would never break the rules or was reluctant to break rules, that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Like he's not a drinker, doesn't really like sort of any, rude jokes or...
Does he swear?
No, he doesn't. He grew up had a very different upbringing from me, and who grew up on the, you know, wrong side of the town, on the worst street in the town. And so he's a very, very straight guy, very, very straighty 180.
You got married and you had kids and he set up an online business. Tell me a bit about the online business Patrick had set up.
Well, initially it started as a furniture business, and then when the market changed, he started to get into doing some other products, and our son actually at the time wanted to order a compound bow. He was wanting to try that. So Patrick thought, okay, well, I'll order you one while I'm placing some other orders.
You mean like a bow and arrow type?
Yes, or right. Bow and arrow. So it's a very popular sporting activity. My son's school does it. Lots of community groups do it. And so he ordered this one, and it was, Patrick was so impressed by the quality of it and the margin. And so he ordered that in, and then he started to restructure his business, and he set up an online archery and camping store.
And was the business doing okay?
Yeah, it was doing extremely well. So he eventually left his regular full-time job working as a civilian at the RAF, and that became his job.
So one day in 2011, that morning Patrick had popped out to go to his warehouse in Penrith, and hadn't returned. And this was a bit surprising to you, wasn't it, when he hadn't responded to your voicemail messages?
Absolutely, because he's always on the phone or always in contact on by email, or he's everything about him is very quick. He's makes lots of calls. He's always on the phone. And so he told me that he was going down to the warehouse. He'd be back in sort of half an hour at the most, and then we'll get heading away on holidays. And hours went by, and I hadn't heard from him. I was leaving all these messages, increasingly angry messages, and I still hadn't heard anything from him, and I didn't know where he was or what he was doing. And at the time, I actually thought that maybe he'd got caught up in the business, because he was quite excited about it, and that's where he was.
And then there was a knock at the door. What happened then?
Yes, well, it was the police, in fact, and it was a whole police task force. And
how many detectives was that at the door?
Well, there are eight in total. And
eight police detectives at your door?
Yes. And it was really very shocking, but at the same time, it was almost comical because of certain things that happened during the raid. Because first of all, our son, Nick, he answered the door, and then he called out to me in the most sort of casual way, as though it was something that just occurred daily, and said, "Oh, Mom, the police are here." And then he just went back to watching TV.
And what did the police say once you opened the door to them?
Well, they identified themselves, and they explained that they were here to conduct a search, and that my husband had been arrested. But they weren't able to tell me the nature of his charges or anything like that, because they were about to conduct a search of our house.
And this is your husband, Mr. Nice Guy. Mm. And that must have been completely discombobulating. Like, what? How confused were you?
Oh, I was extremely confused. And I just kept thinking that it had to be a mistake. And apart from the fact that he is, you know, Mr. Goody Two-Shoes and I mean, at one point he said to my mother that he didn't really want to copy a DVD for her because it was, you know, in breach of copyright laws. So he was, really, really above board. So I kept thinking, you know, it clearly had to be some kind of mistake. Sometimes there were problems with customs, with ordering things in. It had to be something like that. And not only that, but the theme of the whole afternoon of the raid, if you like, was there were all these sort of comical things that happened. Like at one point, a whole lot of teenagers just kept driving around the block, and they knew. I think there was mostly unmarked police cars, but there was one that was clearly a police car, and they just kept yelling out stuff about bacon and saying, "Here, piggy, piggy," and yelling out things. And then when the policemen were searching through the house and we're in our bedroom, and the house was a complete mess. Like, I wasn't expecting anyone to pop over.
Right. And we weren't expecting to entertain guests.
No, let alone a police task force. And our daughter, who was 2.5 at the time, was pulling, like, I'd been packing, and she was pulling stuff out of the suitcases and out of all the grocery bags that I'd been planning to take on holidays. And at one point, the policemen were in our bedroom, and I noticed this negligee hanging over the end of the bed, and I was really embarrassed by it. I just grabbed it, and then very surreptitiously, I thought, just slipped it under the covers. And the detective, he saw me, and so he whipped back the covers, thinking that he was about to reveal this, you know, I don't know what he thought he was about to see, like a semi-automatic machine gun or a big stash of drugs or something. Mm-hmm. And then there was this lacy black thing staring up at us.
Was he embarrassed or did he laugh?
No, he was really embarrassed. He was blushing, and so was I.
Still, this is really completely weird. What kind of questions were they asking you while they were searching your house?
Yeah, well, that's really interesting as well, Richard, because they were asking me one kind of line of questions in front of the video camera, because it was video taped, and they were very calm and professional, and they'd ask me about the house and, you know, where does this hallway lead to, and, you know, very straightforward questions. They were very polite. And then when they're away from the camera, or when the camera was turned off, they asked me very different questions. They asked me questions like, you know, "Do you know the kind of man you're married to? And where are the machine guns? You know, if you tell us where they are..."
Do you know the kind of man you're married to, and where are the machine guns?
Yes. And so they, I think they really thought that they'd caught this big fish, someone who was importing all of these illegal things. And they asked me questions about bikies and about a lot of questions about drugs. And I think they wanted to, they presented, sometimes they said things, I think, just to see how I'd react. Just saying, do you know what he's been up to down in that warehouse of his?
If they were looking for a hidden stash of guns, that would have put him pretty on edge, I would have thought, too.
Absolutely, yeah. I was incredibly shocked and nervous. I didn't know what was going on.
But did they tell you what your husband had been charged with?
No, and I rang the police station. I rang a solicitor who had apparently been sent away from seeing Patrick at the police station, and so that was even more confusing. And they did. They said they couldn't tell me anything because a search was underway. And so if I knew about what the nature of the search was, then if I was
concealed
in,
evidence,
yes, I could
right.
conceal something or try and hide something from them.
So when you went to bed that night, your husband is in detention somewhere. You must have been wondering what on earth is going on.
Absolutely. I couldn't sleep. I just kept going over and over thinking, what's going on? What's going on? And I kept thinking it has to be a mistake.
When were you finally told what your husband had been charged with?
When I arrived at court the following morning and met with the junior solicitor, the only person who I was able to find on short notice, he eventually explained what he'd been charged with.
And what had he been charged with?
He'd been charged with the possession and sale of prohibited weapons. So that was a slingshot and an unassembled crossbow, an assembled one, and an unregistered rifle.
What's the difference in this case between an assembled and an unassembled crossbow, as far as the law is concerned?
Well, apparently, Richard, there are different laws for each state, but in New South Wales at the time, you are allowed to have an unassembled crossbow, so meaning the parts of a crossbow, and that's not considered to be illegal. So he had, Patrick, as I understand, had two boxes of parts of crossbows, and at the policeman's insistence, he did assemble one for him to purchase for the undercover operative.
Oh, I see. So there'd been some kind of a sting involved on your husband then.
Yes.
How had that unfolded, to the best of your knowledge?
Well, apparently the police received a tip-off. We think it might have been from an actual archery store that had closed down at the time, but we're not sure. And they seemed to have the impression that he was some kind of big fish involved with illegal prohibited weapons. So over a period of months, an undercover operative befriended Patrick and told him he was from Adelaide, where crossbows at the time were legal, and asked him if he would please source one for him on selling one. Initially, Patrick had said no, but then eventually, because he did have two boxes of them, he did agree to sell him one
and then another. And what was the story about the unregistered rifle?
Well, his mate, who's actually from Queensland, had been up to visit his father, and his father was cleaning out an old property of his, and his mate had given it to Patrick knowing that he was a licensed owner and said, you know, if you'd like to have this, it was my dad's, you can register it. And Patrick did intend to, but it was, to his knowledge, it was rusty and faulty, and it looked like it didn't even work, so he had to make an appointment to hand it in to the police station or a gun shop, which he didn't do.
So that was, and a slingshot, that's a prohibited weapon, or it's a deadly weapon, or is that how
it's a prohibited weapon,
right?
Yes.
So the extent of the charges, it's hard for me to gauge how serious that is. I know we have strong gun control laws, but nonetheless, that doesn't seem to, how did you feel once you'd heard about the nature of these charges against your husband?
Well, I felt really conflicting things, Richard. I mean, as his wife, and as a mother of our children, you know, of course I was really upset that potentially he'd done something that could take him away from our family unit. And I was furious with him. You know, I felt like I could have done something that would lead to my own prison sentence, to be quite frank. I was, you know, so angry that he had done that. And I didn't want anything to happen to him. I didn't want him to go to prison, or, I was thinking about the financial costs and the emotional costs. But then as a citizen, I'm really glad that Australia has really tough laws for guns and other things. And I think the efficacy of those laws shows.
Once he was released on bail, how was he with you? How did he talk about all this with you?
Well, initially, he said he was sorry, and I think most of all he was angry with himself about what he'd done. But I eventually found out that when a psychologist that he had been seeing called me one afternoon, and she said, you know, I'm only calling you. I don't normally do this, but I'm really concerned that he, because of some things that he's revealed, that there's a possibility that he could self-harm. And I, you know, I was floored by that news, that the possibility that Patrick had entertained the thought that if he removed himself from the situation, that all our problems would be immediately resolved.
And did the therapist explain how bad that line of thinking is, and how untrue it is as well? You remove yourself, you just create traumatised wives and children then, don't you?
Yes, yes, she did. She explained that to me and to him over a period of many sessions, and I think Patrick eventually came to see that, and I think it's a very normal response to people, for people, men in particular, to feel like that. And my very different circumstances, but my grandfather and my uncle had committed suicide, and so I was really reassured, Patrick, that, you know, whatever happens, I think we can get through it, and if you're going through a dark time now, it will get better, it will change.
And did he believe you when you said that to him?
I think he, yes, he did, because he did stick it out, and he did understand that if he was to remove himself, he'd create bigger problems for us and for our kids.
You ended up spending plenty of time waiting in courthouses. What was it like watching people come and go?
It was actually one of the most dispiriting and tragic places I've ever been to, Richard. It was... on the first day that I went to court, I was so nervous about what to wear and how to present myself. I wanted to, you know, make a good impression for the judge and to support Patrick. And so I spent all this time straightening my hair and putting on a suit and high heels. And when I arrived at the courthouse, I just could not believe that there were so many people dressed so casually, like there were people wearing leggings with their, you know, bellies exposed and singlets, and some had no shoes, and it was really quite surprising.
And the sheer messiness of life, I suppose, you would have seen a fair bit of that, just even waiting to go to trial. The sheer messiness of these people you were sitting alongside. What did you make of the trial process as it unfolded for Patrick, watching it all unfold?
Well, it was one of those things that it was a real stress, the trial process. I mean, in every way, financially and emotionally. Initially, most of the charges were dismissed in the local court, and then the DPP appealed, and so it got sent to the district court. But it was actually, it was a very, very long and draining process that went on for 2 years.
What, not like TV then?
No.
Not quite that much drama as you see on
TV. Certainly not, no.
Tell me about the day of the verdict and how that was handed down, what you saw as that day unfolded in court.
Well, we really weren't prepared for a custodial sentence. I mean, even the parole officer who was charged with writing a pre-sentencing report had basically said to me, you know, she put her hand down on the desk and she said, "Look, Mel, you know, I've seen so many people, you know, sitting across from me just like you, and Patrick was the first person to wear a suit to the interview with me, and you're the second. And look, I'm telling you now, there's no way he's going to prison."
Yeah, but that shouldn't make any difference what he's wearing, should it? No.
No. But when you... it shouldn't, but then I suppose all of us... you know, the way we present ourselves can actually, you know, make an impression. And so when you are in the courthouse with people who, at one point, we were there with some men who had, "F the police" written on their neck.
Right.
And so
that's not going to make a good impression with the judge, do you think?
You wouldn't think so.
The magistrate might not care for that kind of language tattooed on the neck of the man in front of him. Right.
You wouldn't think of wearing a scarf.
No, that's right. Perhaps a cravat on that day might be advisable on that day. So nonetheless, you felt, the upshot was, you felt pretty confident that Patrick wasn't going to get a custodial sentence. And then what happened when he was brought into the courtroom from remand where he'd been?
Yeah, so he was taken away on the Tuesday, on the first day of when the sentence was handed down, and he spent a couple of days in remand there, and then he was brought back on the Friday, and the judge had announced on the Tuesday that there would be a custodial sentence, but we just didn't know how long that would be. And then she announced that it was really quite confusing to understand, because all the charges are sort of clumped together and they have different amounts. And so I was thinking, is it 6 months? Is it 12 months? Is it 18 months? You know, and then eventually she explained that a number of the charges all added up to 4.5 years.
4.5 years in prison. And once you heard that and realised that, What happened?
I was just, I broke down, basically. I just could not imagine him being in prison and being able to survive without him being in prison.
And how did he look once that sentence was delivered, when you looked at him across the courtroom?
He was broken, a completely broken man.
Could he communicate anything to you from across the courtroom?
He could. He mouthed that he loved me and that he was sorry and he was crying. And one of the most heartbreaking things to see, because he was actually not wearing a suit at that time, he was wearing his own just casual clothes, because the lawyer had advised him to wear just casual clothes. So he had light grey tracksuit pants on, and he soiled the back of his clothes in the remand centre.
On ABC Radio, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online, and on your mobile.
What were you like when you left the courtroom, Mel? Do you remember how you were when you left the courtroom?
Actually, I don't. I don't remember, Richard. I was. My mother told me that I broke down and I fell to my knees and I was howling, basically. But I don't remember initially.
How did you explain it to the kids?
Well, my mum was really insistent about me telling the truth to the kids, and that was largely because of some of the things that happened to her when she was growing up. Her father had committed suicide, and she knew that her father had died, but she didn't know that he had actually killed himself until she was an adult, and so that really rocked her world. It really upset her, and so she talked to me a lot about how to deal with this with the kids, and said, you know, even though it's going to be hard, I think it's really best if you tell them the truth. And so I'd had this whole speech prepared that when they came home, I was going to tell them, you know, in kids speak, sort of really simple language, that, you know, that their dad had broken the law, and that you know, just like when they do something wrong, there had to be consequences, and the judge decided that because it was very serious and people could have possibly be harmed, it was he has to go to prison, and he has to go to prison for 2 years. And I expected the kids initially to react in, you know, them to be upset, and I imagine, you know, cuddling them while they're in my arms, but it didn't happen like that at all. Like, often kids are so funny that they are so see things in such a black and white way, and often they're so concerned about the things that are the physical things that are in front of them. Like when the kids came home that day, our daughter had called out saying, "Mom, can I have a biscuit?" And then I just sort of wanted to get my speech over with first. And then after she'd heard that, all about, you know, the dad in the prison, she's like, "Yeah, okay, I get it. You know, now can I have
now
a biscuit?"
Now can I have a biscuit? Did they, what happened though with, of course, it would inevitably, I suppose, one or both of them would have asked, "Does this mean dad is a bad man?" And if they asked you that, what would you say? What did you say?
Yes, well, that's a great question, and that did actually happen, because we happen to live not very far away from a women's correctional centre, and sometimes when you're driving past, you can see the women in their green tracksuits tending the cows and working in the paddocks, and apparently, I don't remember this, but apparently years before I'd said to the kids that that's a prison and then people go there, bad people are there, or something to that effect. And so then our son had said, you know, "Mum, is dad a bad person?" And we were driving past at the prison at the time, and I didn't make the connection. And I said, "No, of course not. Why would you ask that?" And he said, "Because you said the people in there are bad." And I said, "Oh, I'm sure I didn't say that. I'm sure I said they did something bad." And he said, "No, you did." And so then we talked a lot. So this whole situation was a really steep learning curve for all of us. And so we talked a lot about good and bad, and about making mistakes and consequences and all sorts of things.
It sounds like you were thinking your way through it as you were explaining it to the kids too, about what you really did think about all this in the light of what had happened.
Absolutely. I, to be honest, I don't think I'd really engaged with the topic before. I just don't think I gave any time to thinking about prisons or people who had been in that sort of trouble before.
Did friends rally to you, or were they ashamed or disgusted or frightened, or what happened there with your friends by and large?
Well, friends and also sort of the wider community, I was really, really surprised well, not by my close friends and family, because I had experienced their support ever since Patrick was arrested, and that was, you know, truly wonderful. But I was afraid I was very afraid of other people judging me and feeling that shame just by association.
Oh, did that take you back to the schoolyard a bit, that stigma of that?
It did. I think I was seeing I went to see a psychologist to help me work through this, and she helped me make that connection. But on some deeper level, there was certainly that fear of that shame. But I was worried mainly for the kids, that the kids would be somehow teased or taunted at school, and people can be cruel. So I decided that I would handle this situation very differently to the way I handled it about, you know, the street that I lived on. I tried to, you know, cover things up wasn't open at all when I was younger. But I decided that I'd actually tell people the truth about what happened. So anybody who was involved with our family through schooling or through sporting activities or anything like that, or work, then I would just, you know, tell them, I know this is really unusual, but I just wanted to tell you that my husband is in prison and this is why. And I totally expected them to treat me like a pariah and not want to have anything to do with me. And I was prepared for that, but I was really surprised that people, basically everyone, was really kind and gracious and really understanding.
Still, once you said, oh, my husband's in prison, was there an initial visceral response from people once you said that?
Absolutely. And it was really quite awful. I think people would do this sort of physical recoil, a sort of jolt, as though they'd kind of been shocked or burned or something. And that was really quite alarming. But then after, I think they were just, it is a shocking thing to hear, I suppose, that people aren't expecting that. But then after that initial shock, then I found that people were so kind and so gracious and supportive. And not only that, I found that people also opened up and told me their stories as well. Like, I found that I was so afraid of people judging me and feeling that shame. But in fact, I found that opening up, that people have shared these incredibly intimate secrets and heartbreaks with me. Like, people told me all sorts of things about having, you know, infidelities or illegitimate children. Or I think they just felt, well, sometimes when you look at someone else's life from the outside, it can look like, you know, they've got everything all together and it's all perfect. And in fact, a woman said that to me one day at school and sort of made this comment about me having this perfect life. And I was saying, well, as a matter of fact, it's really not so perfect. If you must know, my husband's in prison. So it might look perfect, but...
So in a weird way, it sort of invited makes some people like you more in a way than they did before all of this. I'm just really fascinated how being candid like that in a gentle way invokes people's compassion and a willingness to share and a whole bunch of really super intense conversations.
Yeah, I was really astounded by it, and I found that it really drew me closer to other people. And even though the circumstances of the prison situation was quite different, I actually found that all of us, you know, as human beings, are just, you know, we're all, you know, going through the same things in a way. We're all craving the same things. We all want, you know, love and understanding and tenderness, and, you know, and sometimes we all lose our way, or we all, you know, and so. Me opening up, it sort of opened a door, I suppose, and that other people were not only really kind and supportive to me, but they shared their own pain with me, and it was, you know, a really bonding and positive, you know, experience.
You went and took the kids with you to visit him in prison, first of all in the remand centre, then in prison as well. That, what was that whole experience like, taking kids along, having to, you know, navigate your way through the security system, dealing with corrections officers before you were brought to your husband?
Well, in some ways, Richard, it was really, it was really quite, I mean, whenever kids are around you, they have this incredible way of just making things so light and funny. And it was really great to be reminded about what things are like, you know, seeing through things through the eyes of a child. Like, even, for instance, we're walking up on the first time we went to MRRC, and our daughter said, oh, how cute, there's a little dog, how come there are dogs here? And so I was explaining that they're sniffer dogs, and that, you know, they're sniffing around trying to sniff for drugs. And then my son, I'd explain to him that I you know, take antidepressant medication. And so he was really worried then all of a sudden that the dogs would smell my medication and we'd be in trouble. And so he wanted to know if that was in the car. And then they were talking about how they'd find it. And then they discussed and said it would be a good idea if you did want to hide drugs, that you could shove the drugs inside another dog's bottom. And then the dog would just be sniffing another dog's bottom. And so it was just...
You're going, I can't believe I'm having these conversations.
And so the whole time I was just thinking, you know, is this a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, I thought I was helping them, but now they're sort of thinking about concealing drugs themselves.
In dogs, right, as well. But once you, and then once you, you were brought to Patrick, how did he look to you? How was he?
It was really, really humiliating for him seeing us like that in front of the kids. And the kids also found it really hard because they don't like the kids sitting on the prisoners' laps and things, I think, because people try and smuggle drugs in. And so the kids, on the one hand, they could be really understanding, and then the other, especially our daughter, she was very, very upset about not being able to bring her. She'd made this enormous amount of craft that she wanted to bring in to give her dad, and she wasn't able to.
Why not?
It's because I think a number of people over the years have tried to smuggle things in behind glitter and sticky tape and things like that. So I explained to her about why that's not possible. But and that was quite another funny moment. Eventually she told people at preschool, some other parents, that had happened.
What were his letters like to you once he wrote to you from prison, when he told you about the kind of things he was seeing in prison?
His letters were really heartbreaking, but also really, really funny, in a kind of, in a black comic way, I suppose. He often told me stories about situations or other inmates that he thought that the writer in me, I suppose, would find amusing. For instance, when one of his first letters from Manus, I remember he said that he...
I should say this is Manus. It's not Manus Island out in the Pacific. This is actually a detention centre called Manus in southern New South Wales, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes. So he wrote to me and he was explaining that, you know, in the outside world he was just Mr. Average. He had an average job, average house, average life. But in when he arrived down there in Manus, he really felt like he was Stephen Hawking because he was... he'd been in a number of cells with people who can't read or write.
Yeah, that's really common in prison. So many people are incarcerated are illiterate or dyslexic. That's a really common thing. So would he be asked to help out with reading and writing?
Yeah, and he was happy to help out. And he certainly, I don't want to give the impression that he was making fun of these prisoners at all. He was certainly happy to help them. But sometimes there were some funny situations. He was in a cell with, I think Patrick was quite depressed when he arrived in Manus, and understandably so. And he used to sleep from sort of, because the pod gates are locked from 4:30 or 5 in the afternoon, and he'd sleep from 6 till 6 in the morning. And his cellmate remarked that if he continued to sleep that long, he'd sleep a long way through his sentence. And Patrick said, well, yeah, half. I'd sleep half of my sentence. And his cellmate said, how'd you work that out? And he said, oh, well, you know, the hours in the day, there's 12 hours, half of that. And he said, did you count the hours? And Patrick said, no, someone else did. And he said, wow, you are the smartest man I've ever met.
Oh, my God, right. Wow.
So he was in with people who, it was really, really disturbing that our children know more about the world and about maths than they do.
What happened with your kids when they were being asked, where's your dad? Where's dad gone? What would they be candid about that too?
Well, Richard, there's been like quite a big time span now, especially like in the lives of children when our son was 4 and a half, I think, when Patrick was arrested, and now he's about to turn 11. And so that's a really big age gap in the life of a child. And so he's responded really differently at different periods. But basically, you know, the kids were really curious, and then they... I told them there was nothing to be ashamed about. So at one point our daughter was sort of telling anyone who was interested, passers-by on the street.
Yeah, tell me about her show-and-tell day at school.
Yes, well, I received a call from the teacher, and she rang and she said, look, I just wanted to let you know that Lexi told other people in show and tell that her father was in her father's in jail. And I said, "Oh, right. What did she say?" And she said, "Well, that was the incidental part of the story. The main part of the story was that these little shampoos and soaps that she'd brought in from the motel that we'd stayed at when we'd gone to see him, and she wanted to tell everyone about how excited she was to get the soaps and conditioners and shampoo
from Dad in prison."
Yes.
Once he was moved to Manus Correctional Centre in New South Wales, how long did that mean you had to drive to go and see him with the kids for a prison visit?
Yeah, it was a really long way. It was especially including toilet and dinner stops. It was, you know, a 12-hour round trip, really. It would take us about 6.5 hours to drive there, so it was a very long way. Initially, we'd go there for we tried to go every fortnight, but it was just proving too hard.
How did your family start to adjust, though, over time, once he'd been in prison for after a year or so? Did you find yourself adjusting to the rhythms of your new life without him in the house?
Yeah, sadly, we really did. And I recall an afternoon when our daughter, we were lying out in the back deck and we'd been painting our toenails, and she looked at me and she said, "You know, Mum, Dad's really like that towel on the pool fence." And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "Well, he's fading. I can't really remember his face." And that just made me cry. Because it really had happened like that. It's like he'd kind of drifted out of our memories. We'd sort of moved on and we'd got used to it. At first, when he first went away, I thought, how am I ever going to cope as a single mum? But we did. We learned to have our new routine and rhythms as just the three of us.
It turned out your little boy was bottling up a huge amount of guilt about Patrick's prison sentence. Just tell me how you realised he'd been doing that.
Yeah, well, I'd said to him that I could tell that there was something that had been bothering, and I went into his room one day and I could tell that he'd been crying, and he tried to cover that up. And I said, "You know, you can tell me anything. You can tell me anything you like." And then he eventually sort of caved and he told me that it's all his fault that his dad was in prison. And I said,
"How had
why?
He figured that out?"
Well, he thought that it was his fault because he'd initially suggested that Patrick order the compound bow, and because Patrick did, and then that was the impetus for starting that particular business, that if he hadn't made that suggestion, then he wouldn't have been in that line of work and it wouldn't have happened. And I explained to him that compound bows are, you know, perfectly legal. It's a sport. It's, you know, in the Olympics, that he's not in trouble for that. That's, in fact, how, you know, he still has that very successful business. He's not at all in trouble for that.
Man.
But he'd been really berating himself over that. And
silently,
it was just heartbreaking.
On his own. You know, with kids, you can never predict or never in a million years see the ways in which they can find some way to blame themselves for things that go wrong. You would never have spotted that in a million years, would you?
No.
And was he okay after you explained it to him? It wasn't in any way his fault?
Yes, yeah. I think he can absolutely see that now. And I think, you know, telling the kids the truth has really been a blessing for us, like, even though it was often some very, very embarrassing and tricky conversations and situations we found ourselves in. I think it's very exhausting trying to kind of hide something and keep a secret. And just recently it was book week at school, and it was so amazing seeing our son's progress from that thinking like it was his fault and beating himself up to he actually decided to go to book week as himself from my book.
Not many kids can do that, can they?
Well, that was his argument, because I said, "You know what? I really think that you're doing that because you don't have to have think of a costume." And he said, "Well, that might be so, but how many other kids can do this and I might not get another opportunity?"
Eventually, his sentence was reduced and he was given day release. But you're right that when he came back to the family home for the first time, he was kind of alienated from it. What was it like watching him walk around the family home on just a 24-hour day release?
It was really strange. It was sort of like having some, you know, an Airbnb visitor sort of walking around the house saying, you know, where it, because I'd changed a few things around and he was opening drawers and cupboards and to see what was in. And he was asking permission, saying, you know, is it okay if I have a drink, or is it, he'd been away for almost 2 years when he first came out.
Guest in his own house.
Yes, yeah. And I'd done a little bit of renovating, like in our bedroom and things like that. And so some things were quite different and it just felt very different for him.
You were finding him very, he's angry. He'd sort of flare up have angry words with you over very, very, very minor things. How did you find out what was really at the heart of that feeling and that sort of low-level rage you seemed to have all the time?
Well, I ended up calling a really close friend of ours who'd been to see Patrick a lot in prison and had known him for years. And our really good friend, Dave, he ended up saying to me, you know, that Mel, Patrick's seen some things that he didn't want to share with you because he didn't want to worry you. And I was really insistent that Patrick tell me so I couldn't help him, so I could know what was going on. And I began, once he did eventually tell me some of the people that he'd, you know, at one point he was, he shared a soft drink with a man, he ordered some food and he shared a soft drink with another inmate, and the inmate said to him, "Oh, thanks, mate, I was going to actually stab you in the neck this afternoon," because this inmate was about to be deported to another country. And he said, "But I'm going to do that to someone else now because you gave me this." So think, if you think about how we all feel when, if you're in the company of someone who's really negative or angry, to be surrounded by that for such a long period of time has a really damaging effect on you.
How was he when he finally came out of prison once and for all? Was it a kind of joyous reunion once he came back to you from prison?
It was really bittersweet. Of course, it was great to have him home, but it really felt like he wasn't home because he wasn't the same person. He had always been such a positive person, so energetic, and it really felt like I was looking at someone who was broken.
And were you still angry with him? Because you must have been angry too, that he had done this and had unknowingly put you all through this over a two-year period.
Absolutely. I was really angry, and I think until he told me the more fuller extent of the encounters that I'd had and I realised what it had been like for him, did I really begin to understand and to forgive him. And he taught one of the things that's really haunted me, he told me about an experience where when he was travelling back to Parkley, he was surrounded by a group of men who had all found each other, apparently all rapists, and they were boasting about how good it feels to hurt women and to abuse them, and they'd asked Patrick how many women that he'd raped, and he, because he was afraid they were going to bash him, and they were really, really big guys, he'd said to them, "Oh, they haven't caught me for any yet," and these, you know, these men were high-fiving and cheering and talking about how they can't wait to get out to continue doing what they're doing. And when I started to see just what he'd been through, it really made me think about love and how much I needed to really be there to support him through his hardest and lowest time.
Sounds like he had a form of, it's a word that's been used a lot, I know, but post-traumatic stress disorder. Do you think he had a bit of that coming out of prison?
Yeah, absolutely. And he was diagnosed with that. And I think physically, even just seeing him, he was so tense. And he said being in prison is like that because a lot of men in there only speak the language of violence. They might be just sitting there and then they'll lash out at it or stab someone. And he said it's very, very scary place to be.
Right. So you constantly got that fight or flight stimulus at work, right around the clock. You moved from your house to some acreage, being in with some lovely countryside around you. Has that helped him, do you think, coming out of prison?
Absolutely. I think being around nature, there's something really incredible and healing about being in nature. And it was interesting, one of the times we visited him in remand, he mentioned that he really missed trees and he missed nature. And I started to really notice trees and nature. Even though I had access to them all the time, I realised how much I took them for granted. And there was this incredible moment when we saw him at MRRC when he looked up at the sky, this really beautiful clear day, blue sky with wispy clouds. And then I looked up and the kids looked up and they all said, you know, "Is there a plane up there? What are you looking at?" And we're all just sort of looking up at the sky, and it was this moment where everything else was stripped away and you just realise what is really important.
Has this whole experience changed what you think about prison and what prison's for?
Yeah, absolutely it has. And I think just to see, I mean, I haven't done any research and I'm certainly not an expert, but I feel like my opinion about prison is that it really does need to be focused on rehabilitation and on respect. And I think it's fair enough to lock someone away and to never have them re-enter society. But if you're wanting people to come back into society and, you know, to live across the street from you or in the same suburb, then it really is an important investment to treat people with dignity and treat them as human beings.
It's a hell of a story and incredible ride to follow. I don't know if ride's quite the right word, but it's an amazing story nonetheless. Yeah, and it's been really lovely speaking with you, Mel, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
Mel Jacob is the author of In Sickness, In Health and In Jail, What Happened When My Husband Unexpectedly Went to Prison for 2 Years.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Broadcast, podcast and online.
abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.